Tales from Nun's Bottom, Episode 2, Argentine Hearses. Allsop and Tite was more or less the same firm that moved into George Nun's first building in 1946 to fit out hearses. It was Allsop's in those days, and it was Frederick Allsop who took the firm into Nun's Bottom. Well, everyone called him Fred Allsop, but in business he always called himself Frederick, much more appropriate. Then in 1950, Frederick's daughter Mavis married Graham Tite, a carpenter who had come to work for Frederick and got Mavis pregnant in the back of a Humber they were doing for the co-op funeral service. Frederick insisted the little beggar marry his daughter, those were the days, and the little beggar said okay, as long as he took him into partnership, which he reluctantly did. As it happened, the little beggar made good, and Frederick officially changed the name of the firm to Allsop and Tite. 3 years later, with little Tommy Tite still in nappies and Mavis big with child again, Graham ran off with Dolly Catchpoll from the cooperative funeral service. Frederick went after him in a half-completed hearse, a Wolseley they were doing for Bell and Drinkwater funeral directors in Alton. Halfway up the A3, he had a heart attack and, pulling the vehicle safely over to the verge, expired. When Graham heard the news that Frederick's body was in the morgue at the General Hospital, he was overcome with remorse and, leaving Dolly Catchpole in the lurch, fetched his father-in-law's body back in the Wolseley for burial. Some people said it was the thought of getting his hands on Allsop and Tite that made him do it. Maybe they were being uncharitable, but frankly, with his reputation, you couldn't blame them, could you? The co-op did a lovely funeral at a very good rate in recognition of the excellent service Allsop's had given them over the years. Afterwards, Mavis said she forgave Graham, and Graham said he was sorry he couldn't think what had come over him, and he would never leave her again if she would have him back, which she said she would because her children needed a father. And the little beggar was as good as his word. He had a wide variety of girlfriends, but he never left Mavis for them. In due course, Tommy grew up, as did his sister Gloria, and they both went their separate ways because neither wanted to be in the hearse fitting business. Gloria went into nursing and married a doctor and was a bit sniffy about her father's business, so they sort of kept out of touch. Tommy decided it was being called Tommy Tite that had held him back in life and changed his surname by deed poll to Lazarus, after Pete Lazarus, who was big in the music business at the time. Unsurprisingly, being called Tommy Lazarus didn't have any marked effect on his career, not even if people thought he was related to Pete Lazarus, although I suppose not being called Tommy Tite had its own rewards. In 1995, Graham Tite retired from the hearse fitting business and, with no one to leave it to, sold it lock, stock and barrel to an Argentinian named Daniel Ortega. Ortega was a wealthy businessman who had made his money, strangely, from war supplies, which seems to have been a recurring theme at Nun's Bottom. Only the war in question was that fought over the Falklands between his country and Britain, and the surplus in question was more scrap than actual working equipment, given that the British Army had had a jolly good go at it. Ironically, the British government gave Ortega's firm the contract to remove expired Argentinian military hardware from the islands, partly as a concession to his country by way of a Churchillian gesture of magnanimity, and partly because the Falklands being thousands of miles from the UK, no British company was interested. The coincidence of these two facts allowed the British government to be seen to be doing the right thing without that causing anyone any difficulty or, more importantly, costing the British taxpayer any money. In fact, they made a handsome profit on the fee Ortega's firm paid for the concession. Daniel Ortega, as a consequence of this harmonious arrangement with the British, took to visiting the country and liked what he saw. So he bought a home in Hampshire and sold the business in Argentina, intending to retire and live the life of a country gentleman. His wife, though, soon got fed up with him hanging around the house, although it was, fair to say, a very big house, room enough you would have thought for two people not to get under each other's feet. He took up golf, it being expensive, which suited his desire to show his status, and time-consuming, which suited his wife for the reason I just mentioned. It didn't take long for Daniel to make new friends at the golf club, and soon he was accepting invitations to parties, some with his wife and some without, and he began to enjoy the life. Before much longer, these invitations extended to such pastimes as shooting trips, and eventually there was an invitation to join the local hunt. Now, you might think it a cliché that an Argentinian was an expert horseman, but it's the truth. He had a tendency to dash about and show off his horsemanship, which neither endeared him to the other riders, nor helped him to catch any foxes, but they put this strange behaviour down to the fact that he was foreign, a condition that can be held responsible for almost any aberrant behaviour if you want it to. It was a hunt meeting that led Daniel to buy Allsop and Tight. To be precise, it was over drinks afterwards that it first came up. Graham Tight had nothing to do with the hunt. He just happened to be in the Muck Spreader's Arms at the same time as some of the members. That wasn't such a coincidence, because Graham was in that particular pub rather a lot of the time, so they were bound to bump into each other. In fact, he happened to be talking to George Bullier, the landlord, about retiring and what was he going to do with the business. George turned to Daniel, who had become something of a regular by now, and said something to the effect of why didn't he buy it? It was a completely pointless thing to say. What on earth would a retired Argentinian businessman want with a company that fitted out hearses? That's what Graham said, and on reflection, that's what George said as well. He couldn't think why he even thought it. But they reckoned without the fact that Daniel's grandfather had been an undertaker in Buenos Aires. Well, in fairness, they couldn't possibly have known that, could they? Daniel used to visit his grandfather's premises back in the days when most of the hearses were drawn by horses, but after the war, they got their first motor hearse, and Daniel was smitten. He would sit in the driver's seat while his grandfather polished the great long body, the cars, that is. He wanted to be a racing driver, like the great Edmundo Gonçalves. By a huge twist of fate, when Gonçalves was killed in the German Grand Prix, it was his grandfather's hearse that carried his body at the front of the great cortege through Buenos Aires. Daniel kept one of the wreaths that had rested on the great man's coffin in his bedroom, and when years later he was a successful businessman, he had it put in a glass case under a photograph of the driver in his office. So when he heard in the Muck Spreader's Arms the conversation turned to hearses, he was naturally interested. The landlord's bizarre idea seemed in fact quite natural to him. He sat down at Graham's table and asked him about Allsop and Tight, and that's how a scrap metal dealer from Buenos Aires came to own one of the firms at Nuns Bottom. It's a strange tale, I know, but they do say that truth is sometimes stranger than fiction, don't they? You haven't heard that? Well, I have. So Graham sold Allsop and Tight, which when the accountants came to value the business wasn't worth all that much. What was it, after all? A rented lock-up workshop, some tools and the goodwill. It was the latter that was worth the most, although the company's relationship with Cooperative Funeral Services had never quite recovered from the consequences of Graham's treatment of Dolly Catchpole all those years before. When she got back to work after he dumped her, she made sure that any business that would normally have come the way of Allsop and Tight went instead to Markham's, even though Markham's was right over in Kent and more expensive. Dolly's boss, John Quilter, the purchasing manager at the co-op, had always had an eye on her himself, and when she ran off with Graham he was mightily put out. Shafting Graham's business was the least he could do for Dolly when she returned alone. In fact, he did himself a lot of good, because Dolly gave herself to him on the rebound, and they've been together ever since. What happened to Dolly is a minor matter, of course, but I thought you might be interested to know. So the company went to Daniel Ortega, and the first thing to note is that he was simply a nicer person than Graham Tight. At first, the staff were worried about a foreign takeover, and when they met Daniel, their first impressions weren't good. Jimmy Musgrave, the metal worker, said he wasn't taking orders from no foreigner. Jimmy had flirted with the British National Party. Although he hadn't a clue about politics, he knew he didn't like foreigners, and the only other full-time employee, old Harry Henty, agreed with Jimmy, because Harry agreed with everyone. He was 72, and although, as I say, he worked full-time, no one was sure what exactly it was that Harry did. He didn't have a trade as such. He had come to work for Fred Allsop back at the beginning and had stayed ever since. He knew the business inside out, and somehow everything worked because of Harry. You might almost say that Harry was the greatest asset the company had. Daniel was astute enough to see he needed Harry, and he needed Jimmy too, because fitting hearses is a specialised trade and he would be hard to replace. So the first day after the takeover, Daniel surprised Jimmy and Harry. He shut the shop at midday and took them down to the Muck Spreader's Arms. There he plied them with food and drink, mostly drink, until they gave in. Well, until Jimmy gave in, because Daniel could tell where he led, Harry would follow. To Jimmy, anyone who stood around was a friend, and anyone who stood that many rounds was a good friend, foreigner or not. By the time they staggered back to Nun's Bottom, Jimmy couldn't remember why he didn't like his new boss. He didn't change his mind about foreigners so much as what he called argies, a term he was careful not to use if Daniel was around. He decided argies might be all right, and there I can't say if he was right or wrong, because my personal exposure to them is somewhat limited. Nevertheless, it seems that Jimmy Musgrave became a friend of the Argentines, and that can only have been good for international relations. In fact, the only person at Allsop and tight with international relations was Daniel himself, most of his relations being, like him, Argentines. His wife was one for a start, although I'm not sure if your wife is a relation. In any case, she paid one visit to Nun's Bottom and never went again. She thought the whole idea was ludicrous. The estate was dirty and full of rough people, and her husband's workforce, she said two men don't in any case constitute a workforce, were a joke. One, she said, was a loud-mouthed Englishman. The Englishman was an insult for Senora Ortega. And the other was only going to retire when they carried him out in one of their hearses. And being a superstitious woman, she crossed herself as she went into the workshop and crossed herself again as she came out and said it wasn't a place for a woman like her, a sentiment Jimmy heartily endorsed. Jimmy decided that Daniel had made a mistake when he married Senora Ortega, and this made him like his boss even more, because any man who marries the wrong woman, which to Jimmy actually meant any woman at all, deserved his sympathy. Jimmy didn't believe in marriage and said that, as a married man himself, he was in the best position to be a judge. It would be fair to say that the only thing Jimmy did believe in was Jimmy, and as much as he now liked Daniel, that didn't extend to putting any effort into his work, because work was also something Jimmy didn't believe in. It didn't take long for Daniel to figure this out, so he promoted Jimmy to workshop supervisor, which he was anyway because he was more or less the only person doing any work in the workshop. But the promotion went with a small pay rise, and making Jimmy a boss was terribly clever psychology, because in the class war, Jimmy now found himself on the other side, and instead of screwing as much as possible out of the bosses, he found, after a period of confusion about who he was, that was no longer viable. And in any case, they soon had another employee. Inevitably, since Graham Tite had done all the woodwork, Daniel would have to replace him. Jimmy knew another man would be joining the firm, and he was ready for it. He decided he would get off on the right foot by making it absolutely clear who the boss was, and that if the new man pulled his weight, he would get along fine. Yes, Jimmy was ready, quite ready for the new man. Except that the new man was a woman. This was something Jimmy could not have been ready for, no matter how much he tried. It simply never occurred to him that Pat Donahue was going to be a Patricia. Daniel didn't think to tell him. He just said there would be a new carpenter starting on Monday whose name was Pat Donahue. Jimmy's first thought was that Pat was going to be Irish, and he had a bag full of preconceived ideas about what that meant, but he was quite unable to conceive of Pat being female. So on Monday morning, when Pat stood in front of him with her hand outstretched and a big friendly smile on her face, he found himself unable to move or speak. His mouth opened and closed the way a goldfish might when it's drowning. I say that merely to illustrate the scene as best I can, but naturally I've never seen a goldfish drowning, so you will have to imagine it for yourself. I've seen a frog drowning, and come to think of it, forget the goldfish and try to imagine a drowning frog instead. Yes, that will give you a better impression of Jimmy Musgrave trying to understand the person whose hand was still outstretched. He couldn't ignore it forever, and he took it gingerly in his own. It wasn't a carpenter's hand at all. It was everything you would expect a woman's hand to be. Soft, mostly. So then he thought, oh yes, what kind of carpenter has soft hands? Jimmy showed Pat round the workshop, which didn't take long, it not being exactly a big place. And then he asked her if she would like a cup of tea, and she said, yes, please. As he put the kettle on, he thought, bloody hell, what am I doing making a cup of tea for her? She should be doing that. But he could hardly turn round and say to this person who had just arrived in his workshop, actually, on second thoughts, making the tea is your job, so he didn't. In short, Jimmy was confused. And he was confused not only by the fact of a female carpenter and the fact of making her a cup of tea, but also the fact of her being rather good-looking. This was discombobulating him. If Pat had been a man, or even if she had been plain, he would have found it easy to resume his composure, but in all the time he and Pat worked together, which was quite a while, he never did. She retained the power to confuse him. He went through phases, sometimes thinking he fancied her, sometimes thinking she fancied him. But whilst the former was undoubtedly true, the latter never was. It took Pat about 3 minutes to suss Jimmy out for what he was, which was an ignorant, loud-mouthed, chauvinist fool. But what confused Jimmy more than anything was that Pat really was a good carpenter. She had done a City and Guilds course 8 years earlier and had been employed by the council, which prided itself on its equal opportunities employment policy, ever since. The only reason she had left was because the council was a bit low on funds and equal opportunities also covered redundancy. When Daniel took her on, he was a little concerned there might not be full-time work for a carpenter, but in fact business was good, and there was. His business flair far exceeded Graham Tights, and a year later he bought Allsop and Tights' only competitor in the south of England, Markham's in Canterbury. Not only did this give him dominance of the market, but it allowed him to put his prices up, there no longer being any competition. And it meant the cooperative funeral service had no choice but to give him their business. Soon he found the market he was dominating was rather a small one, and he looked around for growth opportunities. He had the expertise and the capacity, and the market he found next was customising limousines. And if they weren't limousines before he got them, they were by the time he finished. The big break came when Allsop and Tights won a contract to fit out a hearse for the prince of somewhere or other in the Arabian Gulf. Just as the pharaohs of Egypt prepared for their deaths with pyramids and whatnot, this chap had his own funeral arranged down to the last detail, including the car that would carry his body to the mausoleum he had constructed out in the desert. The car was shipped over from America, and when it was finished, Daniel had it shipped over to the Gulf. The prince was delighted and had Daniel fly over to talk about another job. It seemed he was having a small fleet of armour-plated Range Rovers built for his family, and he thought Allsop and Tights was just the right firm to fit them out. As it turned out, the armour plating didn't do him much good because the assassin who shot him was already in the car, it being his nephew, who apparently thought it was time he was the prince, so as it happened, the funeral arrangements were finished only just in time. In the confusion of the coup, the last car never got delivered. It had been paid for, but as much as Daniel tried to arrange delivery, there never seemed to be anyone who knew about the order, so he kept it under wraps in the workshop. When a big hearse order came in, there wasn't room for the Range Rover as well, so he drove it home and put it in his own garage. He rather liked the feel of it and couldn't resist taking it out for a spin from time to time, and the inevitable happened, which was that he started driving to work in it. Mrs. Ortega said it was ridiculous, and who did he think would want to assassinate him? But he had the last laugh. He started taking the vehicle to hunt meetings, and one day the hunt master was targeted by saboteurs, and Daniel managed to get him safely into the Range Rover, which with its bulletproof windows, not that hunt saboteurs shoot at anyone, deflected a number of hefty blows from sticks, and the hunt master was most impressed. He thought Daniel was probably more important than he had realised to have a bulletproof car. It did fleetingly occur to him that such cars might be used by people on either side of the law, and Daniel, after all, wasn't British, and what did they really know about him? But he ran a local business and was a member of the Chamber of Commerce, and he really didn't think that he was a mafia boss. The Hunt secretary, Julia Lee Jessop, said the Hearst business would be a good cover for a gang boss because these people might arrange a lot of funerals, upon which the master burst out laughing. And it was 3 weeks before Julia Lee Jessop spoke to him again, which didn't bother him because not being spoken to by Julia Lee Jessop was, in Hunt circles, considered a blessing. Daniel rather relished the gossip about him and did nothing to dispel the myth. He hadn't realised life in England was going to be this enjoyable.